All right. Calling the meeting to order of the House Oil and Gas Committee for Tuesday, the 15th of March, Financial Disclosure Day. Hope everybody's got there then. Still after midnight if you haven't. It's 5:05 p.m. I'm the chair of the committee. My name is Vic Coring, and we've got Vice Chair, Representative Samuels, and member Representative Dahlstrom has joined us. Other members are expected shortly. Obviously, we can't take business on the legislation before us until we have a quorum here. However, that does not preclude us, prevent us from at least hearing legislation. So there's three bills before the committee. Two are new bills. It would be House Bill 197. Here we go, here's my script. House Bill 142, and then we have a bill that was held over from a previous meeting, which was the Bristol Bay Incentive Bill. That's House Bill 71. So we hope to be able to get to that. And my intent is, if it's acceptable to the committee and they feel comfortable with the legislation, is to move these bills out today. So we'll start with one House Bill 97. That's an oil and gas bill that actually I and my staff have produced with the encouragement of the administration that was close to dropping in that bill themselves, unbeknownst to us, I might add, so there was no competition there. We just happened to write it, and then we found out that the administration supported the concept, too. But basically what I'm going to more or less just paraphrase instead of reading you a boring sponsor statement, but what this bill does is deals with an unintended consequence as a result of House Bill 531 last year. That was in my mind, the overreaction, frankly, to the coal bed methane issue where we put into place some pretty restrictive requirements. And when I say unintended consequences, the bill went a little bit too far in terms of requiring C-plans, which is the term referring to oil spill contingency plans. And it also requires proving financial responsibility for all kinds of gas wells, whether there are any threats of oil spill or not. And what we'd like to do is to put in place an exemption to the existing state law for gas wells where there is no threat of any oil seepage through the formations when the gas wells are drilled, which is what spurred the requirement for the C-plans as well as the financial responsibility. Now, AGOCC, the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, which I might add should be online because they are going to speak to this bill, they will determine if the formations will potentially have oil where the gas is being drilled. And if they determine that there's oil, that could potentially work its way through the formations and come out and spill on the ground and cause environmental problems, then they would not allow for the exemption. So it's entirely dependent on what their analysis and evaluation of the formations in the ground are. So what we're essentially doing with this legislation, 197, is clarifying the authority that the state has by amending the existing law dealing with oil discharge prevention. Another point I wanted to make is that with the current law that we have in place, it actually is going to make it harder for smaller companies to operate because with the C-plan requirements, it's going to add to the extra cost and delays associated with gas exploration. So we could actually see less gas drilling and exploration if they're subject to these C-plans and the proving financial responsibility. Again, dealing with oil spills. And if it's determined by AGOCC that there is no potential for oil spills, then they shouldn't have to be subject to these requirements, is our position. So with that, what I'd like to do is turn it over to the testimony, unless anybody on the committee does have any questions at this point. Seeing none, I'd like to turn it over to our testifiers. And I wanted to add that, for the record, my friend Representative Cartulas joined us as of 2 minutes ago. Thank you, Beth. Thank you for helping us to field a quorum, too. That's very nice of you. So I've got several individuals that are on teleconference, not necessarily there to testify, but they're there to testify to answer any questions if need be. So shall we start with Seamount, Cherise, or shall we go in the order that we have on the list here? Mr. Seamount, are you online? Dan Seamount from AGOCC.
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman.
Excellent. Good. Dan, would you be so kind to offer your thoughts in regard to House Bill 197?
Yes, I would, Mr. Chairman.
So much.
What you have just said in your introducing the bill, the AOGCC certainly agrees with. We have submitted a letter of support for the bill that I believe you have in your packets. The AOGCC supports House Bill number 197. We recognize that it amends the laws regarding oil discharge prevention and contingency plans, and also proof of financial responsibility, otherwise known as C plans. It allows better use of the geologic information and expertise that the AOGCC has in understanding the need for such plans. Under current law, the C plan is required for wells drilled to explore for or produce oil, as you alluded to. The C plan is not was not in the past required for wells drilled to produce only gas. However, as you said, HB 531 passed in 2004 kind of had an anti-loophole where the only wells that could be technically exempted were basically only coal bed methane wells, and other gas wells that were not non-conventional after the bill was passed, did not technically have the ability to be exempted from a C plan. So we don't believe that was the legislator's intent back in last year, and it resulted in a mismatch between the current scope of the C plan exemption and the facts of Alaska's geology. And that is, those facts are drilling for gas in many areas, whether it's non-conventional or not, carries virtually no risk of an oil spill. There are thick geologic sections containing both conventional and non-conventional gas reservoirs, but they have very little potential for the existence of zones capable of flowing liquid hydrocarbons. A C plan requirement only adds costs and delay to gas exploration, with no increased protection to the environment. We believe HB 197 corrects the inadequacies in current law by providing for a case-by-case geologic evaluation of wells drilled to explore for gas. And that's by reasonably including all both shallow and deep non-conventional and conventional gas wells. Wells drilled to explore for gas would qualify for a C plan exemption only if the AOGCC determines that evidence demonstrates with reasonable certainty that the well will not penetrate a formation capable of flowing any kinds of liquid hydrocarbons to the ground surface. So the approach of HB 197 is to base C plan exemption decisions on applications of the AOGCC's geologic expertise to the specific facts of a proposed exploration project. We believe that this is exactly the right approach. And with that, I would thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Sir, thank you so much for your testimony. Are there questions from the committee members to Dan's email? One note for the record, we have our friend Berta Gardner, State Representative Berta Gardner, has joined us, who did so as 2 minutes ago at 5:10. Thank you very much, ma'am. We have a House Bill 197 before us, and I did a presentation of the bill just a short while ago. Actually, what I should have done is turn the gavel over to the vice chair in the course of doing that. So I made a technical error, so I apologize for that. Just briefly, Myrna, the legislation, I want to make sure I don't cause any alarm through misinterpretation as to what we're doing here. It exempts from what are called oil spill contingency plans certain gas wells, and it also exempts the financial requirements as far as proving financial wherewithal and so forth when it comes to drilling gas wells where there are no threats to any oil spills occurring. So what Dan Seamount, in the work that he would do as well as his fellow commissioners, they would evaluate potential gas wells before they're drilled to determine what the formations are like to see if there's any potential oil that they could penetrate into that could work its way up to the surface and spill out of the ground. And if the answer is no, that the formations are such that there is no potential for that, then AGOCC and the state would exempt that gas driller from the C plan, as Dan referred to, as well as the financial requirements, therefore making it a more simplified process, a more cost-effective process, particularly for smaller gas drilling companies to go in and drill it.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, thank you very much. If I understand correctly, the DEC already has authority to do this on a case-by-case basis, and this bill simply clarifies
yes, ma'am.
The circumstances under which they can do that. So
And also, we do have folks from the EC that could speak to that. As a matter of fact, I think this would be a...
If that's correct, I'm fine with that.
This would be a good time for Mr. Dietrich to speak to that. But before we get to that, yes, ma'am.
Could I ask a question, Mr. Seamon, before, or whoever, Larry or whoever? But so the bill's going to apply to conventional as well as the non-conventional gas. Is that right?
Through the chair, yes, Representative. It will, but only in the case where we have determined that geologically there is an extremely, almost no risk, virtually no risk of any zones that are capable of flowing oil to the surface.
And forgive me, but that, may I ask a second question?
Sure, yeah.
So is that, right now, are all conventional exploration and production for gas, those wells, are they all required to get C plans?
Through the chair, a lot of the wells drilled before 2004 were exempted, and I think I would defer the rest of the answer to DEC, the law department that represents DEC, if I may.
But it was essentially last year's bill that kind of created this glitch. That's what you're saying.
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions before we go to Mr. Dietrich? Mr. Dietrich, I know you're not signed up to testify, but I'd be grateful if you would offer some comments. Thanks for joining us, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Larry Dietrich. I'm the director of the Division of Spill Prevention Response for the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. We agree with the chairman's summary of this legislation and support it totally. This hopefully will get us back to where we should be, and we rely on the AOGC's determination, and we've relied on their expertise for a lot of the North Slope wells historically. So this will correct that glitch and allow the determination to be made and avoid issuing of sea plans when we really and truly don't need them.
Any questions for Mr. Dietrich from the committee? Yes, Representative Petula.
Thanks, Larry. Do you really mean to get rid of the $25,000 and raise it to $1 million if they've had an incident? I mean, that's a big difference. I don't know if I care, but I just think that's kind of a big jump to take the $25,000 if they've had an incident and buck it up to $1 million. Isn't that, that's what the bill's going to do, right, for financial responsibility? With non-conventional, I mean?
Through the chair, and we have Brett Tosovan on the line here from the Department of Law also, but I'll take a shot at that. Yeah, the intent here is that if the determination is made that there is no oil associated in the reservoir that would flow to the surface, then the requirement for either the financial responsibility or the contingency plan, both are voided then. So there's none at all. And I would defer to Breck if I missed anything on that. I believe he's online from Anchorage.
Yes, he is.
But if they're required to do one, though, if they're required to do a C plan, then they're under the $1 million level, even if it's non-conventional. Am I right? Am I reading it right?
Through the chair, Representative, that's correct.
So then I'm going to jump back. I'm sorry, this bill is kind of circular to me, but I'm going to jump back. So under the current situation, current law, which created this glitch, for non-conventional, they were under the $25,000 per incident. Is that how it was working with financial responsibility? And that's what we're exempting right now. I mean, we're getting rid of that section. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative, that's correct.
So now, I guess the only gap now that I'm wondering about is for the wells that are exempted, what happens if they're actually, if we turn out to be wrong, and there actually is an oil spill, is there any way to go back or any financial responsibility required at all? Or are they simply completely out?
Through the chair, our representative, we rely on the AOGCC determination then of whether or not the potential exists. So if I understand your question is if it turned, and so therefore a contingency plan and financial responsibility would not be required up front. I don't know of any cases where the reverse situation has occurred. I can't think of any in my memory where their determination has been made, and then indeed we've discovered oil, and we're pretty confident in their determination. So I don't think historically that I can give you a case example where it's turned out the other way and then be able to communicate what we've done in that scenario, unless Dan has knowledge of when that's occurred. So I think the likelihood of that occurring is very remote, so there are no specific provisions for that right now. I mean, it would apply at that point, I think, is what it would be a little bit late in the process, but right. FR and the C plan would kick in, I believe, is the way it
once
would
work. Once it happened.
Right. Yes.
Okay. Thank you. I think I've got it. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Any other questions for the committee? Representative Roekberg has arrived as of this very moment. We're dealing, sir, with the House Bill 197. Larry Dietrich from DEC just offered his comments in support of the legislation. Dan Seamount did likewise before that, and we're moving along pretty good so far. Keep our fingers crossed. If there's not any other questions by the committee, I'd like to ask if there are any members of the public that wish to testify on this legislation. Is there anybody here in Juneau that wishes to testify on House Bill 197? I don't see anybody. How about online? Anybody online that wishes to offer any comments on 197? Anybody at all?
Can I ask one quick question before we move the bill?
Yeah.
With the other types of facilities or pipelines that have to have financial responsibility, are they all clearly facilities that would have a possibility of having oil on the ground, and is that the distinction in why we're removing the financial responsibility unless there's a finding that it could go to the ground? Is that the logic to that? I mean, $1 million is a lot of, and it looks like it's triggered by the finding that it would go to the ground.
So through the chair, Representative, yeah, the exemption would not apply to any other of the category of facilities that are regulated and required to have financial responsibility or contingency plan, and those include non-tank vessels, tank vessels, pipelines, the railroad, what am I missing here, oil terminal facilities.
So everything's above.
It's only for the wells.
So everything other than this is clearly above ground, and that's why you're wanting the trigger here, to prove that it's something that really could go to the ground.
Right. All of the other categories of facilities, clearly, yeah, we just don't have the situation where you may not have the oil in the tank, so to speak.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Representative Roekberg, did you have any thoughts in regard to 197? I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but I want to make sure you know where we're coming from. I'd be happy to give you a real brief synopsis as to what the bill contains, if that would be a good thing before we move it.
No comments, okay. Mr. Chairman.
Thank you,
please,
sir.
Proceed.
I would entertain a motion then to move this bill out of committee. Representative Kallstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would propose that we move House Bill number 197 with individual recommendations.
Okay, and the company fiscal note is a zero note, I might add.
I didn't. Okay.
Which you may not have in your pocket. That's why you didn't know. It was something that was late coming, but we do have a zero fiscal note from the department. So without any objection, the bill, as noted, has moved out of committee. Thank you very much. We'll move to the next piece of legislation, which is House Bill 142. This is an administration bill. Basically, it gives AGOCC more control over Class 1 wells, but I'll have the administration present the legislation to elaborate. Therese, is this Seamount going to be presenting the bill? Okay, so we're going to have Mr. Seamount present this legislation, who spoke to 197. Dan, are you ready to present this legislation?
Yes, I am, Mr. Okay. Chairman.
Go ahead and proceed, sir.
Okay, in your packets, I believe that there are a set of PowerPoint slides. Is that right, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, we do have those.
Okay, I will speak to those off of those slides, and if you're not sure which slide that I'm speaking from, please interrupt me and tell me. I'm not going to go into detail on all the slides. That would probably take an inordinate amount of time. I understand I have 15 to 20 minutes. Is that correct, Mr. Chairman?
If you think you can cover it in that amount of time, sure. We're not real set in that time frame, but if you think that works for you, absolutely.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we will go to the first slide. I would, on behalf of the Department of Administration, I would like to introduce House Bill 142, the first slide. This is sort of the agenda. We're going to talk about underground injection control issues in the state of Alaska. And in order to do that, I'll go through what we do and then what the challenges we face are and what are the options. Basically, this bill is going to give us the authority to go after the best options that we can, and in doing so, we will be negotiating with the Environmental Protection Agency to obtain the authority or the primacy of one of their classes of disposal wells. So the second slide is the agenda. We will talk about what underground injection control means and what responsibilities that the AOGCC presently has. What the House Bill 142 says. What is the problem we mean to solve? I will discuss what kinds of UIC well classes there are, which one we have primacy over, and which one we mean to obtain primacy, and then discuss what our situation here is in Alaska, and the situation involves that of redundancy among a couple of agencies and industry, confusion by industry, because you've got basically the same types of fluids being overseen by two different agencies. It's a cost of time and money to all three agencies, we believe, or not all three, but all three organizations, one of which is industry, and then there's the AOGCC and the EPA, and what our options and solutions are. We've got a couple of options, or a couple of options to solve the problems. Either one of these options would involve discussions and agreements with EPA, and this bill serves to allow us to continue into these discussions. And I would like to say right off at the start that the EPA folks that we are talking to right now are much in agreement with what we're trying to do. I think they recognize the win-win situation. They've got a problem that they don't see legally how it can be done, and so we've entered into a task force between AOGCC and EPA to think of creative ways, or we will enter into a task force to think of creative and innovative ways to where we can essentially obtain this primacy. Okay, slide number three, the committee has seen before. I believe it saw it last week or the week before when I was down, discussed what the AOGCC does, and it just talks about our mandate to protect freshwater, regulate well constructions, regulate oil and gas production, and field operations. And we mainly oversee subsurface oil and gas activities. We do have a surface mandate, and that's to make sure that the meters are working accurate so that the people can obtain their fair share of the resource. Okay, the next slide goes into more detail about what our underground injection program is. We regulate what's called Class II wells, and we have primacy for implementing this UIC program that is actually overseen by the EPA. And we do it for purposes of enhanced oil recovery and also for the most environmentally sound disposal of oil field waste. In red, it states that the proper underground injection of material to enhance oil recovery has resulted in billions of dollars in revenue to the state of Alaska and industry. That's the enhanced oil recovery Class II wells, or Class IIR. Also, there are some Class 2D, which are disposal wells that dispose of waste, oil field waste. And I think everybody agrees that the best place to put oil field waste is deep underground, where it's not going to have the potential to spill on the surface. Slide number 5 is just a statement of the statute as it is right now that gives us the power to oversee disposal wells, Class 2 disposal wells, and also the protection of underground sources of drinking water. The next slide shows what change it will be to that part of the statute, and that would be in Section 1 AS3105.03H, and it's amended, and you can see that we're adding to it, it gives us oversight for the control of underground injection related to the recovery and production of oil and gas wells, and it is adding and the control of underground injection in Class 1 wells as defined in the Code of Federal Regulations. So if we go to the next slide that says UIC situation, what we have now are two agencies performing the same job, one protecting a non-existent resource on the north slope, and that is an underground source of fresh water. It's been determined that there are no underground sources of fresh water, and that's one of the things a Class 1 well is supposed to do. Well, you got these Class 1 wells up there that are protecting something that doesn't exist. And this results in onerous and costly requirements on industry and the state of Alaska. Our solution is for the AO, and this bill would give us the authority to do this, is we would obtain control through primacy or having EPA agree that we really don't need Class 1 well, so we would just continue the Class 2 oversight and say that anything on the north slope, everything on the north slope wouldn't be there but for oil and gas operations, and so everything on the north slope is oil and gas waste, so we could do it through putting it down a Class 2 well. I'm getting into an area now that I've been working in for 5 years, and every time I think I got it right, I take it to our expert engineer, and I tell him what I think's going on, and he looks at me like I'm some kind of idiot, and I know I got it wrong. So if it's confusing to you, I certainly understand, because I'm still confused that there are so many different interpretations on what waste can go down what kind of well, and in some cases you've got a Class 1 well next to a Class 2 well, and you've got the same waste mandated to go down different wells based on where it came from. So, I mean, that's sort of it in a nutshell, and it gets worse after that. Anyway, let's go to the next slide. There are 5 classes of wells in the underground injection control under the Safe Drinking Water Act. We're talking about here Class 1 and Class 2. There's a Class 3 well, which relates to solution mining. We don't have any solution mining in Alaska. There's a Class 4 well, which was radioactive waste injection. That's illegal. They don't exist anymore, or they aren't active anymore. And there are Class 5 wells. We have a lot of Class 5 wells in Alaska. That's whatever doesn't fit in Class 1 to 4. Most of Class 5 wells are our waste injectors into the water table. They include domestic septic systems that serve more than 20 people, and some industrial and others. It's just whatever doesn't exist in the first 4 classes. So what do we have in Alaska? You go to the next slide. In Alaska, there are 1,155 Class 2 wells that are overseen by the AOGCC. There are only 7 Class 1 wells. They're all on the north slope. Their construction is very similar to a Class 2 well. As I said before, similar wastes go down them, and we think that we could easily absorb any added work associated with the class one wells. You can also see on the slide on the map that there are so many class five wells. There's more than 3,000 of them that EPA oversees. It not even EPA knows how many class five wells are in the state, or they couldn't tell me. The next slide just gives some more detail. I won't get into it on what we've got going on the two class wells in Alaska, but it does show that a huge majority of the material and numbers of wells are related to the class two project. So let's go to the next slide. We believe that it's a waste of taxpayer and industry time and money to have both two agencies overseeing two very similar well programs. There's confusion by operators over what waste is allowed to be disposed in each class of well, and I mentioned that earlier, and I can get into a huge amount of detail if anybody's interested. Anyone who committee members are free to call us, and we can tell you more about it, but it really gets ugly about as to what is allowed, what interpretations, who interprets what is allowed in these class one wells. But as I said before, all wastes on the North Slope are directly associated with hydrocarbon production, and there are some regions in EPA that say that if it's associated with oil and gas production, if it's a waste that's associated, then it ought to go down class two well, not a class one. That's one of the issues that we would tackle with our EPA AOGCC task force. Much time and energy is expended by the two agencies and industry, but in tracking what waste goes where. There's a huge amount of time and energy that could be allocated in other places. As I said before, there's redundancy. On the North Slope, both of our agencies are running virtually identical programs. And I said before, often the same fluids are injected into the same disposal zones, and different wells are sitting next to each other. The two wells are constructed virtually the same. And AOGCC works on these class one wells anyway by performing a lot of work, advising EPA on their program, and our five inspectors, two of which are on the North Slope 100% of the time, inspect the class one wells as they inspect any other well that the state has oversight on. If we go to the next slide, the Class 1 program, as I said before, it protects a non-existing resource, fresh water. It's an generally an inefficient permit process. EPA approvals are generally much slower than AOGCC, though I admit that in the recent past they're getting better at that. They're still slower. They tend to have onerous and costly stipulations concerning well integrity. EPA has no permanent on-site field inspectors. They regulate only 7 out of 1,162 UIC wells, and I don't mean to speak for EPA, but it would appear that it would be costly and remote for EPA to be running a program out of Seattle for only 7 wells. There is a temptation for industry, from all this confusion about, you know, what to do with these different types of waste or these similar types of waste, to transport waste long distance for surface displacement or disposal in a redundant disposal well, and that leads to a risk of a further risk of surface spills. The next slide I won't go into at all, but it is a cross section that shows the similarity between class one wells, the well on the left, and class two wells, the well on the right. And as I said before, I'm more than willing to come and talk to you individually or as a committee about the details, the technical details of the construction of the two types of wells. OK, Okay, the next slide discusses the confusion about fluids eligible for a Class 2 well. The EPA position is that fluids that have been down, that only fluids that, or this region's EPA position, it's not the, it's, I don't believe it's a position of all the, all 10 regions in the country, but our region believes that only fluids that have been downhole can go into a Class 2 well. And it has to be generated by contact with an oil, or it has to be generated by a contact with an oil and gas production stream during the removal of produced water or other contaminants. There are other regions that believe that waste directly associated with or intrinsically derived from or associated with or uniquely associated with can go down a Class 2 well. It's very interpretive. There's a lot of contradiction to logic, and that is, for example, if you cement a casing into a well bore, the cement rinsate that's returned to the surface after it's gone down hole can go on a Class 2 well, but the rinsate that you don't put down the hole and it's on the same location has to be carried over to a Class 1 well. That's just one example of some of the issues that some of the things that lead to confusion within industry causes a lot of extra work.
Excuse me for interrupting, sir. We have a question from a committee member, Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You hadn't quite got to it. I was alerting you. Okay. I just needed to know what USDWs and SDWAs are on this same page. But maybe we'll get to it.
Okay, through the chair, Representative, yes, a USDW is an underground source of drinking water, which would serve as it'd be like an aquifer in the Matsu Valley.
Of which there are none in the area we're talking about?
Where oil is produced on the North Slope, there are none. The ground is frozen, and none of that water is movable.
All right. And SDWA is?
Sources of Safe Drinking Water Act. I'm sorry, through the chair, Representative, you almost got me there.
Mm-hmm. No problem.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dan.
Okay, continuing on, Mr. Chairman, the next slide shows the historical difference in cost to industry. One of our engineers did an analysis of the differences in costs between a Class 1 and a Class 2 well. And historically, a Class 1 well cost $2.50 per barrel of fluid disposed, as opposed to a Class 2 well, which is $1.50. Okay, we'll go to the next slide, which says options and solutions. Well, we've got three options. The first option, business as usual, would be if House Bill 142 is not passed. And the upside, the silver lining of that is that I wouldn't have to do very much work on this task force. No effort would be expended to change the status quo. But if we don't do anything, we're going to continue to have confusion among industry. Cost to the taxpayer and industry, there's going to be redundancies between the two agencies, there'll be inefficient approval processes, and it is not industry's preference because of the costs associated with it. The next slide shows the two options. The first option would be probably the easiest, and that would be for AOGCC to obtain primacy over the EPA's Class 1 program. This would lead, of course, to less industry confusion. They'd be dealing with one agency, and it would save everybody money. The second option would be to just go to having one class of well for all disposal, and that would be a Class 2 well overseen by the AOGCC. Now, that would need HB 142 to be passed also, and it also need a ruling by the EPA. It would take a little bit more work, but that would be, that's the best option possible. That would result in less energy used for waste determination and tracking, less cost, less industry, a lot of less industry confusion, because they'd be dealing with one class of well and one agency, and it saves everybody money. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm more than happy to answer questions.
Thank you so much. We do have one from Representative Samuel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of questions for you. You mentioned a couple times a task force, but the bill just says take all actions necessary. Is our task force already in place, or is that one of the actions necessary? And if not, what actions are you going to take?
Through the chair, Representative Samuels, we have been talking to AOGCC or to EPA about building this task force. We're ready to put it in place, and that would be one of the actions we would take.
Okay. Are there any others?
Through the chair, we are looking at proposing some regulations in, or writing some regulations, if in the event that we do reach agreement with the EPA.
Okay. Thank you.
Any more questions? Petula and Gardner.
Thanks.
Millisecond before
okay.
Hers.
Okay. All right. I have two questions. The first one is, so there's no underground fresh water source on the North Slope, but what about the permafrost? And is that why EPA is disagreeing with, there's one slide that says EPA doesn't agree with the,
question.
And I guess I stole the other question from Representative Gardner. So could you tell us about that? What is EPA's disagreement, and is the permafrost, is that a problem?
Through the chair, Representative, the EPA definition of fresh water is one that the water has to be flowable in quantities that can be usable, and so under that definition, permafrost does not count as an underground source of fresh water. Did I answer your question?
That was one of them. But I guess the question really was a little broader. I mean, is it because of the permafrost that the EPA is disagreeing? I mean, are they somehow concerned by that? And whether it is or not, are there other concerns that EPA has?
Oh, okay, I understand. Through the chair. EPA, that statement was a little bit too strong, and I have to admit I should have toned it down. The people at EPA that we talked to are in agreement. They would like us to take the program. Their problem is they don't see in the Safe Drinking Water Act where it's allowed, where it is Class 2 primacy is allowed. They don't see where Class 1 primacy is allowed. That's their, they have a legally technical problem with it. We have been talking to other states about whether they have partial primacy, and we found three states. California has an innovative way that they have partial primacy over a certain set of Class 5 disposal wells, which involve geothermal wells. And then New Mexico and Illinois have stated that they have some sort of partial primacy, and I'm going to follow up on those leads.
Okay, thanks.
Representative Gardner?
Thank you. Just to confirm my understanding, if we were to pass this bill exactly as written, we're only partway to where you want to be, and we still then need to get something worked out with the EPA, and that's not in our hands. Is that correct?
To the chair, Representative Gardner, that's exactly right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any more questions from committee members? Representative Roker.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, CMOT. I guess I'm having a little bit of difficulty trying to understand the distinctions between Class 1 and Class 2. You pointed out some examples, which were quite good, but is there a rule of thumb that you use that the EPA hangs their hat on that makes the distinction between Class 1 and 2, or is there a series of criteria?
Through the chair, Representative Roekberg, As I've said before, I get confused, too, after working at 5 years. Industry's very confused. The whole issue goes is sort of a fight between whether confinement of the fluid is most important or legally the type of fluid where it's come from is most important. And that's a dynamic situation. It's been changing gradually through the years. AOGCC trying to be a little bit more, I don't know if I call it reasonable, but we tend to take the position that if we can confine the fluids underground, the type of fluid doesn't really matter that much. Whereas EPA tends to think that if they have to go by the letter of the law, and if they interpret this fluid came from this location or this spot, this operation, and it's got to go down this kind of well, and another one it goes down another type of well, then they tend to want to see more of Class 1 wells. I don't know if I've explained it, but have I explained it, Representative Roekberg?
Well, it's certainly lending some clarity, but for example, it's my understanding many times when you're producing some type of petroleum well that you're going to have the SOX, the NOX, all the bad stuff. You're going to have CO2, you're going to have some very deadly production. From this definition, everything that comes out of a producing well would be a Class 2 well, even if it was poisonous. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that yes, that is probably correct. We haven't had to deal with that in Alaska yet, because we generally have pretty clean oil, very low SO2 concentrations.
But what if you did have an SO2 concentration? Would that be a 1 or a 2?
Through the chair, we would have to have a determination made between... I believe that would be a Class 2 because it came from downhole, yes.
Right.
Legally, yes, you're correct.
But that's very interesting, because you make the point there. If you have a really noxious, toxic substance that you could handle as a Class 2 and not a Class 1 by their definition, seems rather ludicrous. They've set up this criteria that doesn't make sense. I mean, I guess, but that's part of your case, but it might help in making your case better if you use that as an example. Mr. Chairman, just to go ahead, the testimony is that Class 1 wells are like a dollar per barrel more expensive to administer. Is that, Mr. Siemont, just because of the reporting requirements, or why is that as a practical matter?
Some of it, through the chair, some of it is reporting, some of it is, a lot of it is testing, and there has been in the past a requirement to cement the well, Class 1 well, all the way to surface through its deep casing, which many times requires extra holes shot in the casing and more attempts to get that cement to the surface. The AOGCC believes that there are operational problems and there are environmental risks associated with cementing a casing all the way to surface, so that's not necessarily the best way to go, but those are a couple of the reasons. I can get further information for you from our engineering department if you would like.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, Mr. Chairman, by returning the cement to the surface, you mean by when you put the initial casing down, you pump down the cement and it comes up to the outside, back to the surface? But if it's very deep, is that difficulty getting it back? Is that what you're saying, or have I got it wrong here?
Through the chair, no, you've got it exactly right, Representative Roekberg. The cement, if you try to get the cement too high, it'll become too heavy and you could lose it to the formation. So you have to construct multiple stages of cementing, which involves starting at the bottom and then coming up, shooting holes injecting more cement through it, and it may take it multiple stages to get that cement to surface.
So they perforate the casing to get the cement to flow to the top? Is that what you do?
That is correct, through the annulus, which is the outside.
Right, and do you have to, how deep are you talking about here in terms of casing depth?
Through the chair, a class one well can go as, I believe, as deep as 90 some hundred feet, or as shallow as 2,000 or 3,000 feet on the north slope. I don't have the exact details on all seven wells.
You have casing that depth?
Yes, you do.
No wonder it's expensive. I mean, what's typically when you do a north slope production well, what's the casing depth?
Through the chair, the casing depths range to, I believe, over 20,000 feet now. Typical Prudhoe Bay well is about 9,800 feet true vertical depth, but with extended reach well bores, they can go to 13,000 feet or more.
They case all the way now? I'm an old roughneck. It's been a long time.
Through the chair, yes, they do. They generally case all the way. Alpine Field has open hole completions, but the rest are cased all the way to TD.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Rothberg. Any further questions for the presenter of the bill before we move into our public testimony? Okay, what I'd like to do is open it up for a public testimony. And to my knowledge, we have just one individual here, but I'll provide the opportunity for anybody else that wishes to speak. We'll go to the individual that signed up, which would be Marilyn Crockett with the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. Marilyn, are you online? Marilyn Crockett? There's some movement out there.
Can you hear me now?
We hear you now, Marilyn. Thank you.
Oh, what a horrible advertisement. thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Marilyn Crockett. I'm the Deputy Director of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. I hope that you have a copy of our statement in your packet, so I won't spend your time reading through it, but AOGA is a private nonprofit trade association, and our members comprise the majority of the oil and gas operations that occur in the state, and we are in support of the AOGCC assuming primacy for the Class 1 program. Commissioner Seamount's given you a very good overview of the differences between Class 1 and Class 2. And the commission has had responsibility for the Class 2 program since 1986, and what he didn't tell you, but what I will, is that the commission is very highly regarded for its management of that program. The Groundwater Protection Council conducts peer reviews of various state programs, and in 2003, they gave the AOGCC program very high marks, noting that they have a well-defined organizational structure, and they provide quality coverage for all regulatory areas. For the state of Alaska, the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission is the one state agency that has the specific technical expertise needed when evaluating issues related to the subsurface and the structural integrity of wells. And in fact, you have heard Commissioner Seamount talk about the work that they have done rather routinely on EPA's behalf with regard to permitting and management of Class 1 wells in Alaska, including inspection of those wells. So, again, AOGA supports legislation which would give the commission the authority to pick up this program from EPA if that's what EPA determines to do, or to work with EPA to manage the program. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Any questions from the committee members? There is one question I have, and it might actually be, and you're certainly welcome to take a stab at this, Marilyn, but it might be better suited for Dan, given his background in this area, but that is the willingness of EPA to cede basically control and allow the state to have primacy. I would assume that's a given or a likelihood anyway, otherwise you wouldn't have advanced this bill, but I haven't actually heard that comment made. Is that, in fact, a correct statement to make, that they are likely to do that?
Mr. Chairman, I'll take a stab at that. It's my understanding that EPA has said, the EPA Regional Administrator from Region 10 has told the AOGCC that if it is legal for them to transfer this program to the state, that he would support doing so. The rub seems to be in the attorneys reaching the conclusion that, in fact, it is possible to carve off this program, as they have done in three other states for three other programs. So they said that they support it. They're just trying to make sure that they have the legal ability to do that.
Just one final thought, too. I would encourage, assuming that this bill eventually passes the legislature, and that is the administration takes it to the next level and tries to achieve as much primacy across the board as possible so that we have all control vested in the state, not just simply because we know better how to run our state than the feds, in my opinion, but we're achieving greater efficiencies here and lowering costs.
Yes, sir, that's correct.
All right, great. Representative Curtula.
Could I ask Mr. Seamont a question? Please, sort of along the same lines. Once you get primacy, what kind of latitude do you have to go outside the EPA regulations?
Through the chair, Representative Curtula, that is something that we are going to need to reach compromise with the EPA on. They will still sort of be our overseer, and they will be watching us. So, yes, we will have to reach some sort of agreement with them, and this bill is the first step toward that end.
Okay, thanks. Good luck.
Thank you.
We have the next testifier, which would be Mr. Brown, Benjamin Brown, from the Department of Environmental Conservation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Benjamin Brown, legislative liaison for the Department of Environmental Conservation. I'll try to be as brief as possible. We at DEC, of course, abhor redundancy and inefficiency, and it came up in the context of similar legislation being reviewed in the other body. The question was raised whether or not we would have any concerns about this, and in consultation with the commissioner and the directors of the divisions of spill prevention and response and water and environmental health, no concerns were raised. Listening to Mr. Seamount, he's obviously extremely conversant with the issues here, the different kinds of wells, what goes down the wells, and we feel at DEC that they're in a very good position to obtain primacy from the EPA over this, a word which, of course, we like because we also agree with you in a big picture, full of philosophical way that the state of Alaska can do these sorts of things better than the federal government can when possible. So basically, we have no problem with it at DEC.
Thanks for your kind remarks. I do appreciate it, Mr. Brown. Any questions, Mr. Brown? Representative Curtula?
Would this change anything in the way that DEC operates?
No, and the zero fiscal note should indicate that. our operate. And if something in the future did sort of dovetail with our mission, I believe the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission would bring that issue before the legislature, and we would address it at that time. But in the foreseeable future, we don't see any change in our operations.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, I'd like to ask if there's anybody else online that wishes to testify on this legislation. Is there anybody online that wishes to do so that has not signed up? Hearing none, is there anybody here in Juneau who wishes to testify before the committee? Now's your chance, Merle. Seeing none, we have the bill before us. As far as any action by the committee, what would be the intent of the committee? Representative Goldstrom?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 142 with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
All right, thank you. Any objection to the motion as stated? Hearing none, House Bill 142 has moved on to the Oil and Gas Committee, which now goes to the Resources Committee, and it's in the hands of Co-Chair Samuels, which I'm sure will do a good job at that level. So thank you very much, members of the administration, Mr. Tibbles. Appreciate you working with us on this legislation, and we look forward to seeing this go through the whole process. So with that, we'll move on to our third and final bill. We're making good progress here. I'm impressed. The third and final bill is House Bill 71, which is, of course, a carryover from the previous meeting where we already heard this legislation. It's the incentive bill for the Alaska Peninsula Bristol Bay area by the administration. So what I'd like to do is just have the bill re-presented by the Division of Oil and Gas. And my understanding is that Mark Myers, who was not available previously, is now here for that meeting, testifying online from the lower 48. Mr. Myers, can you hear us?
Yes, I can, Mr. Chairman. Right. Can you hear me okay?
Loud and clear. Where are you calling from?
Actually, La Crosse, Wisconsin.
Okay. All right. Well, how about if you just go ahead and give us a synopsis of the bill, and we'll take it from there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What HB 71 does is extend tax credit for exploration wells that was approved under AS 4355025 for a period of time, specifically to the Alaska Peninsula area. and it would be the onshore and state waters portion of the Alaska Peninsula only. So it extends it from the 2007 sunset of this current tax credit to 2010. And essentially what the bill does, it allows a 20 to 40% tax credit for exploration wells if they're less than 25 miles away from an oil and gas unit that existed at the time of the bill passage, May 13, 2003, and 3 miles away from another well or more. They would get a 20% credit against severance taxes. If it's a further distance away, if it's 3 miles away from other wells and more than 25 wells miles away from an oil and gas unit, you'd get up to a 40% credit. Exploration seismic shot outside of an existing unit area would be eligible for a 40% tax credit. And I said those are the conditions currently under AS4355025, and the thought is to extend those specifically for a limited period of time for Alaska Peninsula only, again up through 2010. By adding 3 more years, it would give approximately a 5-year period from the date of the proposed Alaska Peninsula lease sale to apply for these credits. And we believe these credits are important to the Alaska Peninsula because we're starting out in the basin with no infrastructure and basically no modern well data or some seismic data. So this credit would be a significant encouragement, and having it in place prior to the Alaska Peninsula lease sale, we believe pump companies would bid increased amount of dollars at the sale. Again, we hope that also that would bring in more competition for this initial lease sale in the area. One of the other important parts out here is in the Alaska Peninsula is there really is no modern data post 1985 that is gathered other than some basic geologic data recently gathered by the State Geological Survey and the Division of Oil and Gas. So it's really important for exploration success out here to get modern seismic and modern well data shot. So this credit would greatly encourage that. By limiting it to a 5-year period after the sale, they would have to do it, basically do the exploration work early in the primary terms of the leases, and we believe that would accelerate the exploration process. So again, in this particular case, we believe it is appropriate to extend this credit to the Alaska Peninsula. If the current credit running out in 2007 would be of very little use, by the time you acquire your leases and set your program up, you basically probably have one season in which to use it. And again, we think that would be reflected in what companies would bid in the area. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you very much, sir. Any questions from the committee? President Catula and then Gardner.
Thanks, Mark. So part of the bill is allowing the extension for the Alaska Peninsula. But the second part of the bill, or let me remember if we actually did this when the underlying legislation went through, also is going to allow for both sections, so you could get 40% of the exploration expenditures back as a credit, but you could also get 40% more, so you could actually wind up, and you're deleting the section that says does not exceed 40%, so could you wind up really with 80% of your expenditures forgiven? I think we went through that in our last meeting, but I'm just trying to remember.
Representative Catula, the chair, my understanding of the bill is that it merely extends the 40% credit. It's not additive to it. So it would specifically be that the sunset that occurs in 2007 in the bill currently would occur 2010 in the Alaska Peninsula only. So it should still be limited to a maximum of 40% credit.
I may not be understanding the way that the bill is written correctly then. I'm a little concerned about whether or not that's happening. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I wanted to note for the committee, first of all, I'm not going to reopen the public testimony because we had that during the last hearing. However, we do have individuals online from the various agencies that are available to answer any questions committee members may have. We've got Dan Dickinson from the Department of Revenue, who's available for questions, Jim Cowan from the Division of Oil and Gas, and I guess that would be it in addition to Mark Myers, so they're available if needed.
Gardner, sorry, I forgot about you there.
Thank
momentarily.
You. No, that's okay. I'm looking at the list of proposed amendments, and the second to the last one talks about the state receiving data, which it would be able to release after 10 years, and I'm sort of new to this, but what is the mechanism by which the state receives the data for exploration, and can I assume that it's sort of private data, at least while the exploration and the bids are going on, and then at some point, in this case, 10 years, it becomes public information?
Representative Gardner, to the chair, if I may answer the question. Mark Myers again. One of the purposes, again, of the original legislation was recognizing that this particular legislation applied on state, federal, and native lands. And there was two components to getting the data. One is, currently under current law, the state, for management purposes, only gets the data on state lands. And for instance, to get an MPRA, it doesn't get until those wells are publicly released, which is normally after 25 months period of time. So we would get the data for internal use. On seismic data, either state or private land, it is never, or federal land, basically, it's never released in the onshore basins. In the federal offshore, it can be 25 to 50 years before seismic data is released. So two components. One is the Division of Oil and Gas, or DNR, would receive the data if the credit is accepted. And so we would have that for internal use. And again, generally, if it was on state land already, through our lease rights, we would receive it anyway. But the second component is then that data has to be publicly released. And right now, seismic data would not be released under normal purposes. So basically, the applicant would have to provide the data to the state, and after 10-year clock has ticked off, then would have to publicly be able to release it, similar to well log data is released now. So seismic data is never released, but under this program, if you accepted the credit, you'd have to release it no matter whose land it was on, whether it be private, state, or federal land. On the well data, again, under state law, almost all wells are released after 25 months. However, there are exceptions where extended confidentiality is granted. So even if that extended confidentiality was granted, it would still require the well to be released after 10 years. So there's additional public benefit. And I said the other benefit is the state itself, if the well is on private land or federal land, generally does not have the right to see the data until that 25 months would be expended, and we would be able to see the data immediately. And for instance, on some of the wells that have been granted credit in the MPRA, the state has already, DNR has already received that data. And then in 10 years, the well data will be automatically released through AOGCC.
Thank you.
Additional questions? Representative Cartool and then Representative Roper.
Just a process question, Mr. Chairman. I have amendment to place before the committee. I don't know, is there any others, or what's your intention, how you want to proceed right now?
Well, I would like to have hear your amendment. There's no other amendment besides that one, so as soon as we finish our question rounds here, we'll go to your amendment.
Sure, I'll defer to Representative.
Okay.
Thanks. I just want to ask Mr. Dickinson, if he's online, if my concern is El Place, that somehow we're going to raise it to an 80%.
Representative Cartula, through the chair, this is Dan Dickinson. Can folks hear me?
Yes. Yes, sir, loud and clear.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Cartula, no. And I believe what you were looking at is Section 2, where a text that says for a total production tax credit that does not exceed 40% of the total qualified exploration expenditures is being deleted.
Yeah, actually, it's Section 1, but it's Page 2, and it's those two subsections at the top that I'm getting confused by. That's right.
And you know, the attempt here was to make it more clear, and maybe we haven't succeeded when you look there, but the point is, no, you would still be limited to a 40% credit. What we're trying to make clear here, I mean, you will see the 40% credit still exists in both sub 1 and sub 2 of section 1A. And, you know, I can go through the structure of the bill if you would like, but let me try to just get to what we were trying to do there. If you have an exploration well, there are certain costs associated with that, and you can get a 40% credit for those. if you do seismic work, you can also get a 40% credit for that seismic work. We'll never have an expense that both qualifies as a seismic expense and qualifies as well work.
Okay, I got it. Thank you.
You would add, you would take one pool of costs and get 40% on that, one pool of costs and 40% for the other thing. And, you know, we very specifically, if somebody shoots seismic and gets the 40% credit, they can't turn around, say, and sell that data to somebody else who would then come to us and say, gee, for my well, I went out and purchased this seismic. Do I get credit for it again? And the answer is no.
I'm sorry, someone passed me a note, and I missed the very last part of what you said. But what you're saying is you can get it for one type of activity up to 40%, and you can get it for the second activity for up to 40%. So therefore, it's not mixing the two to be 80%, but you can get it for the two different activities up to 40%.
Representative Curtula, through the chair, yes, that's exactly right.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, sir. Any more questions before we go to Representative Roekberg's amendment? I wanted to make an observation that one of the concerns that we talked about last month, if you recall, it's been a while since we heard the bill, of course, was the what we thought to be a loophole in legislation from 2 years ago. I believe it was Senate Bill 281. It was the tax credit bill we've somewhat been talking about here, and we were concerned that perhaps that bill had unintended consequences in the sense that it was comprehensive, extending to private lands and to the NPRA and other federal lands. And I assume that's in part what your amendment addresses, Representative Roper. Is that correct? So yeah. Having said that, would you speak to your, would you like to offer the amendment first, and then we'll have it before us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I have amendment, if you want to mark it, amendment number one. It's,
object.
Okay.
Well, it's 24GH1040-G.2, Genoa.
Okay.
And I'd move amendment number one.
It has, been objected to, so...
Mr. Chairman,
yes,
to explain the amendment, I request an amendment today from our legal research people. What this would do would be to restrict the credits granted in the bill previously for the law, current law, and the new law regarding Bristol Bay or Alaska Peninsula, and would exclude private and federal lands from being able to qualify for the credit. Mm-hmm. Now, Mr. Chairman, I offer this as what I believe the proper policy would be, but I would ask that the committee take it up, and I'd like to see the bill move along to the Resource Committee and then give the opportunity to the agencies to review this as a matter of policy and then bring it back up to board at the before the Resource Committee. This bill stayed here quite a while, and I think it needs further discussion, reflection on this issue, and I'm certainly not hard and fast on it, but I'd be willing to work with the administration on this and with the chairman of the Resource Committee on this to see how we want to go forward on this. But I think that this is appropriate at this juncture to you know, kind of fire a shot across the bow of what public policy should be. And additionally, I think it raises the question regarding what we should do as a matter of public policy. I think one thing I have learned regarding discussions on this issue is that I think ultimately the legislature in its historical context of allocating resources from our and monies from our natural resources is probably, I would say, I'm reluctant to say this, perhaps made an error in their ways in the past, particularly as it relates to federal lands and the National Petroleum Reserve and how those lands are, and those monies are allocated. There's some case law that actually, it's my understanding, allocates monies from royalties, bonuses, and bids from the federal lands on the NPRA that even allows the North Slope Bureau to take their share before the 25% mandate into the permanent fund is counted. So I think this particular area deserves some review by the legislature. There's also provisions for special legislation relating to impact monies not used by the North Slope Bureau going into the PCE or Power Cost Equalization Fund, all these things before it flows to the state treasury. So this is not so much the fault of the current administration or anything as much as perhaps the legislature and the and so forth. I think it's time for a review of this. It's a huge, big problem. We shouldn't be slowing down some legislation that has merit when we, over another unrelated, if you will, policy. So I wanted to bring that out, make a comment on that, offer this amendment for the committee's consideration, with the understanding that we'll, I think, deserve a review and further discussion as a matter of policy.
Thank you, sir. Representative Salmon, do you care to speak to your objection?
I just wanted to hear what it did, and I got a couple of questions.
That's really, I thought we were going to have a battle in our hands here.
Oh, no. This amendment, without going through all this.
Oh, if I would, yeah, if you'd like me to.
The statute, I was just curious. Does this address the permanent fund question that you just said?
No, this just says
the NPRA doesn't get the credit. Is that
right? No. Right. What this says right here, as the drafter drafted it, looking at line 3 of the amendment, it just cites these statutes and what they are. The first one, the AS 3805-131 to 134, that is the provisions for exploration licensing under our statutes. The next one, 3805-177, is non-conventional gas leases that we did last year. And the other one is 3805-180. That's all of our oil and gas leasing statutes. So the way this amendment has been drafted, it merely states that it's only on state lands that these credits are allowable, thereby excluding, in our wondrous drafting manual, it goes through the back door saying you have to be on state land here, thereby excluding privates and federal lands for qualification. It's a mere drafting method here. And all due respect to our drafters and our drafting manual, which I hate, because you can't tell what this does. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, frankly, what this does, the effect, Mr. Chairman, is to say, and this is prospective only. I mean, it would have an immediate effect today, but it only come into play for those applications for credits that occurred after the effective date. So all my interpretation of this would not affect any activities currently underway that would qualify for the credits on private or federal lands anywhere. So everything that's done and been committed qualifies. This would only apply to a 2-year window remaining through July 1st, 2007, exclusive of Bristol Bay Area or the Alaska Peninsula, and then apply only then to the Bristol Bay Area. Frankly, Mr. Chairman, I think it might be up to the next committee referral or further discussion on this, whether we want to even include that, whether that's appropriate. I'm not sure exactly how much, for example, privately held subsurface estate exists in the Alaska Peninsula area. There may be a large component of Bristol Bay Native Corp lands that might qualify for split estate interpretation and maybe might be appropriate. So, but that demands or begs the further question and examination. But that's what the actual amendment means.
Right. Well, it wouldn't surprise me if we're going to see a flurry of activity between now and when this bill goes into effect of those that do intend to take advantage of private lands and federal lands. It's a possibility, I suppose. Yes, Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I'm trying to understand, since we know now that the previous committee understood that the tax benefit was going to apply to federal and private lands as well, what the benefit would have been, why we would have done that. Mm-hmm. And obviously, if we get the seismic data, that's one benefit to the state that they wouldn't otherwise have. If there's development that results in jobs, that's another benefit. Are there any others? I mean, is there any other reason that would have been a...
Representative Samuels?
If you get the oil, you still get some of the other taxes that flow from it, so the royalty.
If it's private land?
Yeah, I mean, you still get a portion. You still get ongoing money, whether or not you want to pay for it. It's a policy call.
Right, I mean, it is.
I will remove my objection, and before the next committee, there are people from industry here, and there's people from revenue here, and there's people from DNR sitting right there in the room, and...
Mr. Chairman, if it's appropriate, I can answer that question.
And who would this be? This is Dan?
Excuse me, this is Dan Dickinson with the Department of Revenue.
Go ahead, Dan.
And again, I can't speak for the committee, but I can certainly speak for the reason why we included state, federal, and private land.
I'd like to hear what the justification is.
Correct. And the notion would be, I think it's incorrect to think that we get more that automatically we'll get more revenue from state land than we will from non-state land. The severance tax will apply to all production, whether it is from state land, federal land, or private land. In fact, if it's on private land, the severance tax will apply to 100% of the production, whereas if it's on state or federal land, we do not tax either our own royalty share or the federal royalty share. So the real determinant on how much severance tax is going to be arriving is going to be the economic limit factor. So you could have, for example, let's say Anwar were to rush through. So at one example, we were to be drilling in Anwar, and you found a very large field there, you would get a lot of revenue because you might have a very high economic limit factor. Compare that, say, to a well drilled in the Cook Inlet, where the economic limit factor is zero, so you get zero severance tax, even though it was on state land. Again, on income tax, we get income tax from the increased production that flows to the companies that drill. And again, if it's on private land, we will be taxing both the landowner and the working interest owners. Whereas if it's on state land, we don't tax ourselves. If it's on federal land, we don't tax the federal government. The royalty share, private land, obviously we get no royalty share. On federal land, it can be highly variable. Maybe Mr. Myers can speak more knowledgeably about this than I can, but obviously at some point, folks have talked about a 90-10 split of the royalties. So again, significant royalties could be flowing to the state even though the drilling was on federal land. And finally, property taxes. Again, assets that are employed in the use of oil and gas, whether they are on state, federal, or private land, all the property tax will flow either to the state or to the borough in which that those assets are located. So for the four sort of major bites of the oil and gas apple, none of them can you say with certainty, gosh, we'll get more if it's on state land and less if it's on federal or private land.
Thank you, Dan. Does that help?
It does. Thank you very much.
President Roper?
I'm not sure I agree with him. Particularly if, Mr. Dickinson, what if the subsurface estate was owned by the Native Corporation or the private holder? You would have no severance tax bite, would you?
Representative Roper, through the chair, yes, the severance tax is on any production in the state less that owned by the federal or state governments.
Oh, so you can charge a severance tax on privately subsurface state. Hmm.
Representative Roper, through the chair, yes.
Right. Yeah. But not royalty, so that would be the differential there, right?
Representative Roper, through the chair, that is correct. The royalty would not flow, but the severance tax would.
And Mr. Chairman, what would be the impact of this particular, the current legislation that expires in 07, if by a miracle the Anwar resolution were to pass through the Congress this year and be implemented in the federal 06 budget, which would put out the bonus lease sale to in during before July 1, 07, thereby creating bonuses of, and if George Bush is right, of $2.6 billion to the state, what would be the impact of this credit if those bonuses were to come before July 1, 07?
Speaking of Anwar, Congress had taken up that issue today and they were going to vote on an amendment to
6 o'clock in the morning.
And they've since bumped it up till tomorrow. Yeah. But we're all going to keep our fingers crossed and hope and pray for the best that they vote it through. For those of us that are religious, we'll pray.
Yeah, Mr. Dixon, could you tell, in fact, if the bonus bidding would occur, I'm sure there would be no development activity before 07, but what would be the impact of the bonus bids of the current law here? Anything?
Representative Roper, through the chair, I think Mr. Myers may be able to answer that more specifically. I don't know it in the current budget bill whether it's still the 90-10 split and whether that would apply to the bonuses.
Well, it's 50-50, but that's neither here nor there.
Fair enough. Then it would be 50-50, so then we would pick up 50% of that bonus, which if it is $2.1 billion, if I do my math, that'd be
$1.05 billion. Right, no, it's $5 billion, so, right.
Okay, well, we do have an amendment still before us. And
no, we need to have the answer to the questions.
Okay, excuse me.
to Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, this is Mark Myers. Do you, did you want to hear what the typical royalty rates are in terms of federal?
What happened to the ANWR bonus bids, anything at all, if we don't amend this bill?
Representative Roku to the chair, fundamentally, the ANWR bonus bids, I believe, because the geologic prospectivity is very, very high there, because the expectations are high, I'm not sure that extending this credit one way or the other would make a lot of difference. In an area like Alaska Peninsula, where it doesn't have infrastructure, it's gas prone, certainly the economic incentives and the bidding levels are going to be significantly lower. You know, ANWR again has those high USGS estimated oil recovery numbers of up to 10 billion barrels technically recoverable at the mean case. So we're looking at, you know, a spectacular oil and gas oil province with respect to the estimates currently available based on the seismic information in the refuge and then also surrounding well data and geologic analogs. And in the Alaska Peninsula, we're looking at kind of a very different beast. We're looking at an area that's predominantly gas prone. I think it's an outstanding candidate for LNG project, has some oil potential, but that being much, much smaller on the scale. So we're looking at basins with very different prospectivity. And again, I don't think extending this credit into ANWR would significantly change companies bidding, because they would bid a lot of money for it anyway. On the other side is, if you look historically on the North Slope, much of the revenue stream coming from the royalties is typically higher than that for the severance tax component. So again, there are cases where potentially severance tax could be higher, but those are very, very unlikely cases. So if we look at this year, for example, the severance taxes are about all taxes together are about $1 billion on oil and gas, and the royalties are about $1.4 billion, so they're significantly higher. And the third comment I'd like to make is that generally the federal government has offered incentives where they needed to on their lands as well. So in effect, subsidies or incentives have been talked about in NPRA. They have not been implemented, but they certainly have been talked about. In the federal OCS, they have put on sizable incentives, royalty holiday type incentives on sales. So, and then Gulf of Mexico, they've applied similar mechanisms. So on federal lands, you have multiple options, not just the state potentially giving a tax credit. The federal government can either do a royalty holiday or a tax credit themselves, and do that in many basins.
Representative Samuels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mark, I realize it's probably hard when you're not sitting there looking at the amendment to, but I think what Representative Roker's amendment would do to make sure that we don't give away the farm at ANWR. I don't think there's a lot of debate or any question on the peninsula and realizing the difficulty that lies ahead for the explorers on the peninsula, but I think the point of the amendment was to look at ANWR and say, well, let's see what happens first before we start giving tax credits at it. That, to me, is the point of the amendment. And we can certainly, as I said before, I'll remove my objection to the amendment, and then between now and when we have the resources meeting on this, we'll talk to industry, and we can talk to DOR and DNR and all of the various players up there and Representative Roekberg and work with him and see if we want to keep it or modify it and see what we want to do. But in the meantime, I'll remove my objection to Amendment number 1.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just add, yes. I appreciate that. This is for production against a lease because it's a severance tax credit. So it becomes a question about what the incidence of it, and I'm not sure that's entirely clear here. Because if you had a bonus bid and you applied for it before July 107 in ANWR, I mean, I'm just not sure. That just needs to be, we need to make sure that clear as a bell. And because I think there's nobody here that would, anybody could disagree that you don't need to incent that type of thing. I'm not sure this really applies, but let's make sure it doesn't. And I think it also does demand this debate about whether the private and federal leases elsewhere in the state need to be included. And, you know, I'm open on it, but I think it needs further scrutiny. Mm-hmm. So okay. I'd really appreciate the indulgence of the committee. Mm-hmm. We vote the bill out, but I'm sure that it's got three other committees of referrals, including the Rules Committee, that could get it straight before it finally gets to the floor. So I think we need, this is an important bill. I'd like to see it move. Yeah, I appreciate your indulgence, Mr. Chairman.
Absolutely. I do appreciate your efforts at trying to clarify in law as you have with this amendment. So I appreciate your efforts as well, Representative Roper. The objection has been removed. Is there any further objection or any further comments on this amendment, Representative Petula?
Thanks. I just want to sit down with Mr. Dickinson or whomever and look at the grammar of that one section, too. I hear what he's saying between the seismic and the exploration. I'm just not sure the language is quite there yet, so.
And we can work with you on that also.
I'll look at that and report to the resources chair.
Okay. Okay. Since no objection, the amendment does, in fact, pass, and now we have the full bill before us. What is the pleasure of the committee? Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move the CS for House Bill 71 with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
As amended?
Okay. Amended.
Any objection to the motion as made, as presented? Hearing none, the bill moves out of committee. Thank you very much, everybody, for your efforts, for your late attendance once again. And given our good work, there's no reason to have a meeting on Thursday. So we've concluded all of our business for the time being. I wanted to let the folks know that we did have a successful Energy Council meeting, and I'd like to present a report. I took a lot of notes together, a lot of information. I'm going to put a report together for the benefit of the committee and provide that in the next few days or so. But it was a good, productive 3 days in D.C., and we have obviously a lot of support for what we're trying to accomplish in Alaska, the gas line to Anwar and other things. So we'll look forward to seeing you at the next meeting, which is to be announced. With that, at 6:35 p.m., the oil and gas meeting is adjourned.